Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
At Joshua Generation, we give communion every week. And I'm going to read some scriptures this week, and I know it's a little different.
This is Pastor Brandilyn Mangum Deer on a recent Sunday morning in Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
As you hold your communion, just hold on to it. I want you to hear these words.
She's reading from Luke chapter 22, verses 19 through 20.
He spoke a prayer of thanksgiving. He broke the bread, gave it to them, and said, "This is my body, which is given up for you. Do this to remember."
This is a familiar ritual to all of us who have spent a lot of Sundays in church. But here in this church, the part about Christ living inside all of us, it can feel like a literal lifeline.
Who are you? I am. You take the flesh and you drink the blood. Jesus remains in you and you in him. Don't forget.
Joshua Generation is part of a denomination called the Metropolitan Community Churches. It's what's called a welcoming church. The ministry speaks directly to LGBT Christians.
When someone tries to stop you from being who you were created to be, whether it be an L, a G, a B, a T, a Q, a P, a plus, an S, you say, "I am. I am. I am who I am. Because he lives in me. And nobody, not Uncle Scar, not the governor of Mississippi, not the legislation of hate, nothing can take
Pastor Mangum Deer, she goes by BB, actually. BB and her whole congregation are in direct battle with the state of Mississippi. They're all plaintiffs in a suit challenging a law that is supposed to protect them as Christians, but actually makes them feel like targets as LGBT people. The law, it's often just called House Bill 1523. It does a few things, but its main point is to protect a set of beliefs from, quote, government discrimination. Specifically, three: that marriage is between a man and a woman, that sex belongs within the bonds of marriage, and that gender is a fixed trait assigned at birth. Here's how Governor Phil Bryant describes it.
There's no intent. There's no one on the part of the Mississippi legislature or the governor's office that wants to discriminate or harm anyone. This is simply, if they are worried about protecting people's rights, also understand that people of faith have rights.
Needless to say, this has sparked a fierce political fight. The Mississippi law has been in the national news alongside Texas and North Carolina's so-called bathroom bills, which force people to use bathrooms that correspond to the sex listed on their birth certificates. Together, these three states have become the new front line in a very old American culture war. I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety, Culture Wars. And in this episode, freedom of religion. America's long, twisted debate over how government ought to balance one person's religion against another person's civil liberties. Over the past decade or so, the LGBT rights movement has in many ways been ascendant. The legal debate over same-sex marriage is resolved. Popular culture has widely embraced gay and lesbian people, and transgender people are rapidly opening up space too. And gender identity in general is going all new places. Even Facebook lets you choose the non-binary gender pronoun they in your profile. And so, a new idea has emerged. That those who feel their faith is challenged by this political and cultural shift need protection too. Jenny Pizer, the law and policy director for Lambda Legal, which is a group that litigates on behalf of LGBT rights, she says that in this year alone, dozens of bills have popped up in state legislatures all over the country.
Some of them are of a type that are now commonly called First Amendment Defense Acts.
And they basically say people should be exempt from having to do things that infringe upon their religion.
It's a new type of very aggressive, really unprecedented elevation of religion over all other interests.
You're likely familiar with this. There have been fights about cakes.
Welcome back to Hannity. The owners of Sweet Cakes Bakery in Oregon, they were ordered to pay, get this, $135,000 in a fine last week for refusing to bake a wedding cake for a lesbian couple.
And also about health services.
A federal judge in Texas halted an effort to strengthen transgender rights. The efforts were blocked over health rules that some say could force doctors to violate their religious beliefs.
But as Bibi's life suggests, these laws and the story behind them actually reveal that there's always been something kind of off about the way this particular culture war is framed, as one between religion and faith on one side and civil liberties and personal identities on the other. For one, there's the obvious fact that two people of the same faith can have very different ideas about its teachings. Or sometimes the same person can be in debate with herself. Before Bibi was the pastor of a welcoming congregation, and before she had come to terms with her own sexuality, she was part of an addiction recovery ministry, one that did have gay members, but
we tried to pray the gay away, and we almost treated it like an addiction, as if they were on drugs or alcohol, but we were trying to rescue them, put them in gay recovery, I suppose.
When she finally started getting honest with herself about her own sexuality, she confided in a friend from her ministry. The friend told their head pastor, and the pastor told everyone. He outed her from the pulpit, and he demonized her.
I went in a moment from being the pastor Brandolin, who helped drug addicts and alcoholics get their lives together, almost a hero, to being an abomination in a moment.
So she began the process of redefining her faith and building a faith community that embraces her. But the whole saga taught her something that informs her role as a plaintiff against Mississippi's HB 1523 today.
Most people think they don't understand what the bill really does. They think that it's really just about religious freedom, and it's more than religious freedom. It's discrimination in a pretty little religious box, which is, we're good at putting things in religious boxes here in the South.
And actually, this new idea that religious people are threatened by the expansion of civil rights for other people, it's not that new. The idea emerged decades ago, right here in Mississippi, in reaction to desegregation. Our producer Jessica Miller has the story. It begins in the Jackson, Mississippi office of a Presbyterian minister and activist named Rims Barber.
Clearly, my accent is not native Mississippians. I've only been here for 50-some years.
Rims Barber was born in Chicago, but he came to Mississippi during the Freedom Summer of 1964, and he ended up staying.
Several years later, went to a Presbyterian meeting and was up saying something to the body, and one of the old-timers from the bad old days, white guy, got up and said, "Aren't you the guy that came to Canton in 1964 and ruined our race relations?" I said, "Well, you got the year right."
I mean, this is a guy who has been in it. He officiated the first interracial marriage in the state of Mississippi. It was 3 years after Loving versus Virginia, the Supreme Court case that officially legalized interracial marriage. And he still had to go to a federal court to get the marriage license. When we visited him, he was wearing a shirt with a quote on it from the Book of Micah.
"What does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God?"
That's a principle that Rims built his life around. Back then, he used to hear a lot of people use religion to try to get out of things, like permitting an interracial couple to get married, or like the mandates to desegregate the schools and churches of Mississippi.
We heard the religious rhetoric about separation of the races 50 years ago, and we hear the same kind of rhetoric about gays and about immigrants today. You know, it's just the same old mindset that people are trying to perpetuate. You know, white superiority doesn't give up easily.
So that's why, at 80 years of age, Rims has put his name down as the lead plaintiff in a class action lawsuit against the governor of Mississippi, Phil Bryant. The same lawsuit Pastor Brandilyn Mangum Deer and her congregation have joined.
Well, the lawsuit of Barber versus Bryant. Yeah. I am a plaintiff in that lawsuit. My name is on it, and I'm proud of that.
Rims is not gay, but he put his name on the lawsuit because he says the bill violates his religious freedom. Remember, he's a minister.
I believe that the governor of the state of Mississippi cannot tell me what my religion ought to be. I will decide that in my heart and in my church and my family. And there are no superior and inferior ways to God.
When Rims Barber first arrived in Mississippi, he spent a lot of time working on school desegregation. It wasn't easy work. He said he got chased out of town a few times, even thrown in jail. And I should say, Rims is white, and he wasn't a school child back then. The actual kids who were desegregating, well, they had it worse.
One of the kids who desegregated school not too far from here, what's now a suburb of Jackson, that first night, her mother called us and said, "They're burning a cross in our front yard." I said, "We'll be there in 10 minutes, you know." And I remember we called the FBI office and they said, call the local sheriff. I said, "I think that's him out there."
This is after Brown v. Board of Ed. Shouldn't be a problem, right? But just because the law changed didn't mean the culture changed. And this battle over school segregation also set the stage for today's fight over religious freedom.
Well, I mean, I get going on this narrative, and it's kind of hard to stop me.
Randall Balmer is a professor of religion at Dartmouth College. He spent more than 10 years of his career investigating the foundations of the religious right, as well as interviewing a few of its architects.
The religious right did mobilize in response to a court decision, but it was not Roe v. Wade in 1973. It was an earlier court decision, actually, at the District Court, District of Columbia, in a decision handed down on June 30th, 1971, in a case called Green v. Connolly.
Green v. Connolly, a case that originated in Holmes County, Mississippi, a school district that Rims helped desegregate. In Holmes County, as in many places, desegregation was immediately followed by movements in the white population. People left the cities, pulled their kids out of school, all because they didn't want to have to comply with the new law.
The first year of desegregation, the number of white students in the public school system decreased from over 700 to 28. The second year of desegregation in Holmes County, Mississippi, the number of white students in the public school system decreased to zero.
It led to the formation of a whole variety of segregation academies where white people could flee to.
That was Rims Barber again. And those segregation academies he remembers were private Christian schools set up for white kids in Mississippi and Virginia and all the places where desegregation was going on. And because they were religious schools, they were also tax exempt. Well, a few people in Holmes County didn't think that was right.
Any institution that engages in racial segregation or racial discrimination is not, by definition, a charitable institution.
In 1971, a federal judge made it official. But it doesn't end there, not by a long shot, because the arm of the federal government that starts to enforce this is the IRS. They begin looking around. They're searching for segregated schools outside of Holmes County. Their radar lands on Bob Jones University, a fundamentalist, segregated Christian college in Greenville, South Carolina. And the IRS issues a warning: desegregate or lose your tax exemption. And now the culture war is on.
Okay, so Jess, there's still something I don't understand, though. What does desegregation have to do with religion? Like, why are we talking about this here? What are all these institutions really holding on to?
So remember back in episode 2 when we were talking about the Scopes trial? Race and religion went hand in hand back in 1925. To say that all races were created equal or that they should mix, well, that rattled a lot of people's religious logic. And even though now we're 4 or 5 decades down the line in our story, a lot of people are still thinking that way. I mean, the truth is, people tried to put religious loopholes in the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
So they wanted to use religion to avoid integration.
Yeah. And P.S., after the Civil Rights Act passed, it was still an issue. I mean, there was just case after case. A chain of barbecue restaurants called Piggy Park claimed that they shouldn't have to serve black people because it violated the owner's religious beliefs. We just talked about Loving versus Virginia. The first judge who heard that case said in his decision that God didn't want interracial marriage. And that's what Bob Jones was doing here, too. They claimed that to integrate their campus and to lose their tax exemption if they chose not to do so, that would violate their religious liberty. Here's what one of their lawyers had to say about it.
One of the religious beliefs of the university is that the scriptures prohibit the intermarriage of the races, and that it would be scripturally wrong for members of different races to marry. Based upon that religious belief, which has been its belief since the commencement of the university in 1927, I believe, it has refused admissions to blacks. It has admitted a few Orientals under a rule that says those who are admitted cannot date members of other races while at the university. The university feels that at the college level is when most romantic attachments are formed between parties and when their life's partners are frequently chosen. For that reason, it has adhered to the policy that no blacks are admitted to the university.
But those sincerely held religious beliefs were not enough for the IRS. In 1976, after 5 years of warnings, Bob Jones loses its tax-exempt status. And so this community that had stayed out of politics for so long begins to organize. Randall Balmer says evangelical leaders like Jerry Falwell seize an opportunity.
They mobilized evangelical voters to block the Internal Revenue Service and its attempts to deny tax-exempt status to racially segregated institutions.
Most evangelical people weren't even registered to vote in the middle decades of the 20th century. But the day Bob Jones' tax-exempt status gets revoked,
January 19th, 1976,
a certain Southern Democrat wins the Iowa caucus.
Hello, Jimmy, Jimmy Carter.
A born-again Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher, evangelical Christian by the name of Jimmy Carter.
You'll make a great president.
And evangelical voters emerge. But under Carter, the IRS continues enforcing the law, and it becomes increasingly clear to a once apolitical group of faith leaders that they need to become political players. Though keeping a school segregated wasn't exactly a PR-friendly platform. Abortion, however, that was. And so in 1979, Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority is founded.
And I am optimistic about America. May I begin by saying that I feel that America is, in these 1980s, particularly in this decade, experiencing a moral and spiritual rebirth.
And the standard narrative behind the emergence of the religious right is that these evangelical leaders were morally outraged by the Roe v. Wade decision.
This is Randall Balmer again.
It's a narrative that's been repeated many, many times, and it is also a piece of utter fiction.
He says that over time, people forgot the segregationist roots of the religious right. It all became about Roe v. Wade and the right to choose.
And yet, whatever the religious right's origin, the culture war it has waged over morality is a very real one and has been for nearly 40 years. But that movement's most potent weapon right now, it isn't the president, who won huge support from white evangelicals. It's not even something the right came up with. It's an idea created by people who really, truly truly believe in both religious freedom and civil liberties. That's next. A few episodes back, we told the story of composer Aaron Copland creating a sound that captured his idea of America in the 1940s. We asked you to name a piece of art that captures what you think the American idea is today, or at least what it ought to be. And we just had to share what we got in from Kathy in Binghamton, New York.
All I could think of was the art of Fred Rogers in his children's show and how he managed to turn conversation into a delicate psychological dance of just caring. And I've turned not a few of my own students towards his YouTube videos when I see them feeling disconnected and feel that brings them all together no matter what their politics are and no matter what their personal situation is, to just be told that somebody with authority and kindness can accept them with love. Thank you.
Keep sharing with us. Today's episode has us wondering if you've ever found your own political and religious values in conflict. How do you resolve that tension? Call us up and tell us your story. 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. Be sure to leave your name and a number where we can reach you. We may use your story in a future episode. And a bit of housekeeping before we continue. In an early version of our most recent episode on the white nationalist movement, I misleadingly collapsed the timeline of two separate campaign speeches that Hillary Clinton gave about racism on the alt-right. I made two speeches sound like one speech. We caught the error and corrected it, but if you listened to the episode in the first hours it was available, you heard the mistake. So we sort of punished you for being a fan, and that's lame. I regret the error.
What if millions of Black Americans had been compensated for slavery? Join me, Trymaine Lee, as I explore the untold story of one of the only Black Americans who ever was. I talk to his descendants and discuss how reparations forever changed their family's trajectory and imagine a reality where reparations are paid to the rest of Black America. Into America presents Uncounted Millions, The Power of Reparations, a Black History Month series. New episodes drop Thursdays. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety, and we're talking about faith and politics. Back at the top of this episode, I mentioned Mississippi's House Bill 1523. Remember, Governor Bryant says it's totally not about attacking gay couples or transgender people.
There's no one on the part of the Mississippi legislature or the governor's office that wants to discriminate or harm anyone.
He says it's just that if we're going to give LGBT people rights, we have to protect people of faith from those rights. And round we go. But these kinds of bills are popping up all over the place now. They're controversial, obviously, but also confusing. I mean, freedom of religion is literally the first right stipulated in our Constitution, the First Amendment. So you might ask, why does it need more protection?
Well, actually, the idea that religious freedom needs more protection came from many of the same people who wanted to codify sexual freedom, people who want to expand all kinds of civil liberties. And it was because of what happened to a man named Alfred Smith.
I want to speak to my brothers and my sisters that are in this audience, and perhaps others that may be listening to a tape.
Here he is in 1990, just days after the challenge he took to the courts changed the concept of religious freedom forever. He knew it.
I want to apologize to you, my brothers and my sisters, who are natives of this land. If any way this case has harmed you.
Alfred was a Native American born on the Klamath Reservation in Oregon. As an adult, he became a member of the Native American Church and adopted the practice of taking peyote, a hallucinogenic cactus, during certain religious ceremonies. But it's complicated, because when he decided to adopt this practice, he was also working as a substance abuse counselor in the state of Oregon, and using any kind of drug was a fireable offense. He lost his job over it in 1984. But Alfred didn't think that was right.
Here they're telling me, no, if you want to keep your job, you can go to the ceremony, but you can't take the sacrament, you can't take the peyote, you can't take the drug. And I had to make a decision. They've been doing this to my people from the time that they got here.
He sued, and his case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And there, his lawyers were tasked with proving that taking peyote counts as a legitimate religious practice. And as you can imagine, the justices sometimes had a hard time wrapping their minds around that concept.
The use of peyote in these ceremonies is at least in part for its very hallucinogenic properties. That is to say, the religious experience, at least for some communicants, comes from the achievement of the heightened hallucinogenic effect, where this is also not true of the ingestion of sacramental wine.
Is there any special spiritual feeling at taking communion?
Well, the feeling is different than the induction of an actual altered state of consciousness.
But what substances do or don't induce religious experiences is not what's really on trial here. What is on trial, what everyone is assembled here to figure out, is if the government has a good enough reason to stop Alfred Smith from his personal religious expression, whether federal drug laws and employment laws in the state of Oregon can eclipse religious freedom. And guess what? The Supreme Court says that, at least in this case, they can. According to Justice Scalia,
mere possession of religious convictions which contradict the relevant concerns of political society does not relieve the citizen from the discharge of political responsibilities.
Scalia is effectively saying that Alfred's religious practices are not more important than the law. When it comes down to it, the government gets to decide what's legal and what isn't. And let me tell you, that freaked people out. A very real fear started brewing in all types of religious communities and on both the right and the left that this was government overreach and that it could be used against them, too. So that's why Alfred Smith's Supreme Court decision kicks off a new fight to protect religious practice.
Literally the day after the decision, there was a meeting.
Barry Lynn is the executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. He's also an ordained minister in the Church of Christ. But when the Smith decision came out, he was working as a lawyer for the ACLU in Washington. The day after the Supreme Court makes its decision about peyote, he gets called to this meeting in Orrin Hatch's office. Some other lawyers are there, some faith leaders, but most notably, Ted Kennedy is there. He and Orrin Hatch are running the show.
And if those two people got together and both thought the decision was wrong, there was a hope, widespread hope, that something could come of all of this.
It turns out it didn't matter where you fell on the political spectrum or what religion you were. Everyone assembled in this room agreed that the Smith decision was government overreach. Because once they can mess with a Native American church, they can mess with you too. The politicians are off and running.
Under Smith, the practice of using sacramental wine, wearing a yarmulke, kosher slaughter, and many other religious practices all could be jeopardized.
Okay, so we're listening to some very bad tape from 1993. It was the 90s. We only had VCRs to record off of C-SPAN. Sorry. But anyway, that was Chuck Schumer introducing something called the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act to the House. Ted Kennedy introduces something similar in the Senate, and Orrin Hatch is the lead Republican sponsor. Barry, the lawyers, the religious groups, and the congressmen have been battling it out for 3 years, and this is the fruit of their labor, billed as a restoration of the First Amendment freedoms lost in the Smith case.
But incomprehensibly, Judge Scalia's decision explained that requiring the government to accommodate religious practice was a luxury. Tell that to the millions and millions of Americans. Religion is a luxury, and I think you'd get the reaction that we have had universally here on the floor from the most liberal to the most conservative member.
Kai, look at the coalition that came together to endorse this thing. It's called RFRA. That's R-F-R-A, Religious Freedom and Restoration Act.
Yeah, and I remember this. It's a pretty impressive list. I mean, it's organizations representing Jews, Christians, Muslims, Scientologists, Quakers, Mennonites, Sikhs. I mean, it's a long list. The Americans for Democratic Action, the ACLU, the Association of American and Indian Affairs.
So they've been working on crafting this language for 3 years. Here's how Barry Lynn describes that process.
Well, this is a good example of not wanting to watch how meat is prepared in a slaughterhouse and not really wanting to watch how legislation is done either.
The bill that passes, the act that Bill Clinton signs into law in 1993, it was a monster compromise. one that ultimately had huge unintended consequences.
Today, the High Court striking down a key provision in the Affordable Care Act that requires for-profit companies to provide comprehensive birth control coverage.
Which brings us to Hobby Lobby.
The evangelical Christian owners of Hobby Lobby.
The chain of craft stores that said it would be a religious burden on their company to provide contraception to its female employees, and won big at the Supreme Court in 2014. Hobby Lobby won their case because of a new, expanded interpretation of RFRA. It was decided that a for-profit company could have protected religious rights, too. Barry told me that nobody working on the original bill saw Hobby Lobby coming.
If those of us who knew where this piece of legislation would go and where its clones would appear in terms of state legislation, I think some of us, I'm speaking just for myself, would have never gotten involved in the process from the beginning.
Of course, the thing about all of this, this confounding political fight over religion, is it complicates the deeply personal struggles many of us already have with our faith. Like Pastor Brandy Lynn, BB, back in Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
Me and God had a good wrestling match. But I think God had to take me through all of that so that I could have the empathy that I need and the resolve that I need to build a LGBT church in South Mississippi.
She says her first move was to get herself out of isolation.
Because I didn't know any gay people, and I knew they had to be there, and I was good at support groups. You know, I built an entire recovery ministry for drug addicts and alcoholics, so I wanted a support group for LGBT people.
So Bibi started a group with the help of the woman she'd begun dating, who would later become her wife. They called the group the Dandelion Project.
We started having meetings in our living room every Wednesday night, which is church night, and it grew like crazy. Just the LGBT kids and adults were just coming out of nowhere, and we had this 30 and 40 people in our living room every week.
It wasn't church, though, not at first. They just focused on social issues, and you get the sense that for Bibi, it was like penance. For her previous work trying to convert gay people to heterosexuality, the Dandelion Project's first principle was come as you are. That's a big deal for Bibi on a few levels. In her former ministry, even before she came out, fellow congregants constantly policed her personal appearance, her piercings, her tattoos, the way she dressed. Now, she proudly sports a full sleeve of bodywork. She says it's her visual testimony, the story of her faith. It begins with a dandelion on her shoulder.
I started with the dandelion because when I first got saved and first met God, He gave me a dream. And in the dream, I walked down. It was in my old church, and it had the big stained glass windows. And I walked down.
She walks down the aisle toward where she felt God's presence.
And I looked up in my dream, and the walls were gone, but the stained glass windows were there, and the wind was blowing through the sanctuary, and I could see the streets in our church.
She realized the walls of the church were confining God's word, keeping its message all locked away from the people who actually need it.
And God was showing me that the work goes beyond the walls, and He showed me the dandelion later on, and that's, you know, each one of those little fluffs has a seed, and when the wind catches it, it carries it, and it goes, and it multiplies.
The group's weekly discussions gradually moved toward action. They didn't just want to talk. They wanted to create change. So they joined the fight against the first version of Mississippi's religious freedom law. And all of this, the support group and the activism, it restored Bibi's faith.
And after about 2 years, I told my wife, I said, it's time to start a church. And she said, if that's what you want to do, let's do it.
She says the way her former church rejected people like her and the values the state enshrined in HB 1523, these things, they're just not actually Christian.
But people in the South are stuck. They're stuck in their traditions and their laws and in the literal word of Scripture. And so they justify discrimination, whether it be racism or homophobia or transphobia. They justify it through Scripture because it is the Bible Belt. And as long as you're a good Christian in the South, you're good. It's like a ghost from the past that keeps resurrecting itself in different forms. It's time for us to exorcise that ghost and cast it out in the name of Jesus, you know?
She realized her wrestling match wasn't with God. It was with the stuff everybody else wanted to do in God's name. The United States of Anxiety Culture Wars is a production of the Narrative Unit of WNYC News and WNYC Studios. Jessica Miller and Reniqua Allen reported this episode with help from Jillian Weinberger. The Narrative Unit team also includes Rebecca Carroll and Patricia Willens. Bill Moss mixed this episode with help from Matt Boynton. Casey Means is our technical director. Hannes Brown is our composer, and our theme was performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Andy Lanzett is our archivist. Our digital team is Lee Hill, Diane Ginty, and Jennifer Hsu. Jim Schachter is vice president of news for WNYC. Karen Frillman is our editor and executive producer. And I'm Kai Wright. Talk to you next time.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.